You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
So, what are you guys going to do? Are you going to continue to be a bunch of soft, underperforming, tattooed millionaires?
They said all along, perfection is not possible. We just want to get the big decisions right.
What are we doing? What are we doing?
Green room getting hot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
The right answer was a goal in Times Square so we could do butts up, but that was a decent one.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental on MLSsoccer.com. I am Andrew Wiebe in the green room with David Goss, Bobby Warshaw, and Matt Doyle. The gang is all here, and that's because it is MLS Cup Week. I repeat, it is MLS Cup Week. We are less than 7 days from putting a bow on 2018. 8 p.m. Eastern on Saturday at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Atlanta United, Portland Timbers. You can watch it on Fox, Unimas in the U.S., TSN, TVA Sports in Canada. Oh, it's here.
So you're more excited for MLS Cup Week than you are for Draft Week. Because right after MLS Cup, we have the expansion draft, the waiver draft, the reentry draft version 2.0.
The real reentry draft, as we all know.
Yeah.
Semi-beginnings of free agency.
Yeah. The draft, I mean.
It's tough. I'm a big expansion draft guy.
Have you ever written a draft column?
I have not, but I'm guessing
like
you
draft,
have.
Like drafts ranked?
Oh.
That's what I'm saying, man.
Oh.
Just so the listeners know, Weeby's always looking for low-hanging fruit for those columns.
Exactly. The easiest possible solution for the written word is always my approach.
But you see, the problem is there's only so many lists and fake lineups you can make.
Exactly.
Now challenge, I know what's challenge accepted,
wow.
Bobby. What's, challenge accepted.
What goes on behind closed doors is no longer secret. The roast of Andrew Wiebe has begun, and I feel like you guys had some practice on this one. Of course,
we also had a lot of help. Yeah. If you want to go to the mailbag now.
Oh, really? No. Let's not do that.
You want to save that for later?
Yeah, let's save that for the mailbag.
Are we going to get Andrew to rage quit the podcast the way Bobby rage quit FIFA today?
By the way, Extra Time Radio FIFA preview of MLS Cup went exactly as you all thought it would, which is Bobby just miserable in the entire time. Just in misery. I won't give away the result, but Bobby lost bad. And that'll be out soon. Timbers fans might be disappointed in their representatives, let's just say. It's kind of the same, actually, as the odds for MLS Cup that 538 just put out. 77% chance they say that Atlanta United will win the cup. I feel like it was more like 100%.
Yeah, that
Dave
100%.
And I were going to wipe the floor with you guys, but you'll have to watch the video evidence
guys,
for that one.
You guys are going to drive me insane with this. I am going to have to buy like a PlayStation and start gaming again. And when that happens, it's all I do.
Yeah,
and I am going to lose my job because of this.
We've ruined your life. I guess we won't get that.
As long as it brings the trolling text you send me down a little bit. If you spend so much time playing that I get trolled 2% less every day from you, I'll take it.
If you are looking to get trolled, MLS Cup Central is going down Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. That's our preview shows leading into the big game, 7 p.m. Eastern on MLS channels.
Spending those preview shows trolling people?
Doyle generally does. Doyle does. Susanna Collins, David Goss, you know him, and Jillian Sakovitz are on site in Atlanta giving you all the reports from there. We've got special guests in the pregame show, MLS Cup Central, 6:30 p.m. Eastern on Saturday. We will be at Mercedes-Benz Stadium for that one in the flesh to witness it. Bobby and I will not be shivering in the stands as we have done in the past at BMO Field. Coming up on this show, Justin Meerum to
Why
talk
are
about
the only
Greg
two that were cold
Berhalter.
At MLS Cup.
Everybody else was, but we were standing next to each other, all right?
God, that's you're such a complainer.
Just the way it goes. Justin Meerum's coming up. He's going to talk Greg Berhalter. It's now allowed, Dave. Because it is official. He is the head coach of the U.S. national team. We're also going to talk to Paul McDonough. He's the sporting director right now for Inter Miami. But since 2015 until, I think, this summer, he was the VP on the soccer ops side at Atlanta. So he knows an awful lot about how they built it, why they built it, what it means, and maybe what it means for his current job. Worry not, though, Timbers fans. We are having Gavin Wilkinson, the GM and president of soccer, on the Timbers side on Thursday's pod to look at that side of this game. Back to 77%. Does that jive for you? That is a big number.
It's way too high. Right?
Yeah, it feels high.
Why? Because it's a one game and it's soccer and everything.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely favorites. But
so in the last 7 years, how big a favorite is Atlanta this time compared to every other MLS Cup?
Let's say to Toronto last year, Toronto being at that time the team that we had exalted and put on high.
Except they'd just lost to Seattle the year before at home.
True, but they dominated that game. Everybody looked at that game and said, you should have won that. This is your time for redemption. Right. And I don't think we would have put that anywhere close to 77%. Now, Timbers fans are just waiting for that other shoe to drop and us to say that the Sounders were better. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily true either.
I don't know.
Bob is the numbers man. He went to Stanford.
They're not as big a favorite as the Sounders last year. I feel like they're maybe in line with the Sounders in 2016, which was a different Seattle or a different Toronto team because they didn't have Vasquez. They're not as big favorites as Galaxy in 2014.
And then KC.
2015 was a toss up. 2013 was like 55-45 at best for Sporting. So this is, I mean, they're big favorites, but it's not, I guess it's just not as much as last year. And I don't think it's 75%.
Bobby likes numbers. What are your numbers here, Bobby?
I'm not sure they're big favorites. I think they're slight favorites, but I expect this game to be much, much closer than people expect just because that's what Portland does. I mean, Portland plays this great equalizer of a style. So, yeah, it's in Atlanta, and Atlanta is better in the regular season. They probably have more overall talent, but I expect this to be a 57-43 type game is where I would put the odds right now.
How much more does this game mean to Atlanta? Yeah. Love it.
Because if you say 58, you're out of your mind.
He spent all that time, and I was like, he's not going to give me a number. He's definitely not going to give me a number.
No, there's a plus-minus range of four.
Okay.
Yeah.
Five.
How much more does this mean to Atlanta? Timbers have won one. They're on the road. People don't believe in them. You see 77%. They are taking the log all the way from Portland to Atlanta, so they plan to cut that log in some way, shape, or form, whether it's just goals or it's a title. This, to me, feels like it means a lot more for Atlanta United.
Why does it mean something? Sell to me that this means something to the franchise that started 2 years ago.
Because Tata's leaving. He's the man who built what they built, and his legacy is going to end tomorrow or on Saturday. It's not because he built the club and they'll continue.
And it's also part of just Atlanta's fiber as a sports town. Like, it's Loserville. The other than the Braves winning 20 years ago, they haven't won anything in any of the stuff they care about, whether it's the Falcons or college football, whether it's you know, the Hawks are kind of like incredibly inept as a basketball team. They need this. They need something to be theirs. And right now, they're the best story in MLS and have been for the past almost 24 months.
But the point of Atlanta United is those fans, as far as I understand Atlanta United fans, aren't other Atlanta sports fans. That's why they're Atlanta United. It's a transient city, and people come in with the NFL team, the NBA team of their previous city, and they all adopt.
And so I think the argument would be that this victory, like a victory in MLS Cup on Saturday in front of 70,000 people, and with the eyes of not just the town, but the region, and not just the region of the United States, but like this region of soccer in the Americas, with the eyes of soccer in the Americas on Atlanta, to have that moment where they ascend to the top, and their star coach who's going to be moving on to bigger and better things, and their star players who are going to be sold.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, maybe not better, but their star players who are sold for $20 or $30 million, bringing home that title and like setting off a frenzy of a celebration. I think it means a lot.
All the scenes so far have been incredible, and I think we've all been to Atlanta for a game. Is that true? Everybody's been there for...
I've been there for All-Star. Let's not call that a game.
Okay, good point there. The scenes are special.
I was there for marketing.
They're making headlines. Arthur Blank said it. We want to be a part of the world conversation. International prestige. We want that. Well, you don't get that unless you have titles, unless you win. And so at home...
Arsenal.
Well, they did at one point, and they're still clinging to that thread all these years later. But this is that opportunity to launch yourself into history and just say, you know what? Chicago Fire might have done it year one, but we did it year two, and we're going to be the team that stays here. We're going to be that drives this league forward. We're going to be the standard bearer.
Also to what Bobby said, which is a lot of these fans aren't Atlanta sports fans. Now you put yourself in a conversation, as Doyle said, of we're the winners. We win. If you come to Atlanta United games, you get to see a fun game. We're going to win. You know we're going to win every time. That's something that everyone can jump on and be like, you know, Atlanta United's the franchise in our city that we know will deliver. And we're going to show up to the finals because we're not going to be heartbroken.
Did we see the Falcons stadium yesterday? Everybody saw those pictures. Does it go viral every time it happens? Mm-hmm. And nobody's there.
Right.
It,
And I call it the Falcon Stadium because when Atlanta plays, it's their stadium and it's full.
And it's like in New York, right? Like, it's like people come to New York and they know the Mets are losers and the Knicks are losers.
God, this
and like
is so
the Giants and Jets are losers. It's a
Oh, no. Sorry, your mic broke. Let me see if I can fix that. Yeah,
no. I would have called it an RB2 town, but
yeah.
But listen, I totally get what you guys are saying about the benefits of them winning. And I think the idea of greatness being rewarded. Atlanta United, from Arthur Blank all the way down, has been great since the first moment. I just find it hard to really say, in the midst of all the great sports stories around the world, that this team that just formed 18, 24 months ago is this beautiful sports story. I think it's amazing and wonderful.
But isn't that what makes it so beautiful? Is that it kind of like
no,
a phoenix rose
suffer,
out of
man. This
rose
is sports.
Out of nowhere.
This is sports. You gotta feel pain and anxiety and depression before you get a great sports
okay,
story.
Well,
that's
a Phillies fan
right
there.
Yeah, let's talk
that's
about MLS Cup and not the FIFA game we just played earlier. 8 p.m. Eastern, Big Fox, Unimas, TVA Sports, TSN. We've got the game preview, the nitty-gritty, the tactics, the back and forth, the ta-ta versus Savarese. That's coming up on Thursday. Today, we got a lot to talk about. And let's just jump in on Berhalter here before we get to Justin Meerum. It finally happened. It happened on Sunday during EPL broadcasts to pull in all the different audiences, Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very good chance that we will have a special interview with Greg Berhalter coming up for you this week. I cannot promise that. I want to, but I cannot. So look out for that. We will let you know if it does come. Dave, you said you wouldn't talk about it until now. So now I'm opening the floor to you. If you have anything to say, now is the time to say it. Have you been holding back?
No, I think my point was we had already discussed Greg Berhalter as a manager for the U.S. national team. We've done it a few times on this show. We all have feelings. I think all of us. Well, actually, I don't need to speak for you guys because it doesn't matter.
Yeah, what are your feelings?
I think he's a good coach. The one thing that I like about him coming into international soccer is his pragmatism in big games. Understanding I want to be a possession team. This is how I build my team. And when I go up against a team that A, it doesn't work against, B, I'm not good enough to beat, or C, there's extenuating situations. My guys are flying from Europe to Honduras and they land 12 hours before this game. I don't have to play that way. And I have the ability, because I'm such a good coach and I'm detail-oriented, to instill another style to win that game that my players can understand. So that's the part above all else that makes me excited about him. I think he's gotten better out of players than they've done the rest of their career, or maybe better than I expected those players to be capable of, which is good for a national team because you can't trade guys and sign a new guy. I think he's been good with young players, and so I think that's going to be key for the U.S. And he's detail-oriented. So you talk about guys not knowing if they were coming to national teams under Jurgen Klinsmann until 10 hours before the national team camp started, not knowing what position they were playing, not knowing who was captain of the team, into a system with Greg Berhalter where he's going to be consistently talking to these guys throughout the year, not in camp, about what they want to do, how they want to play, where he wants their role to be in the national team.
Has the whole process discussion been overblown? It's a question. It's taken 14 months. In that same amount of time, okay. Well, not that – it took me 8 months longer to have a baby and get engaged.
You know
– you know, that's all I'm saying.
It had to get there, didn't it? Yeah. Do you want to talk about the engagement? Congratulations.
No, not right now. Maybe later. Maybe the mailbag. But I'm just saying.
The
you
reason
had, you felt like you had
we,
something.
We've already well, talked on the show. The reason the process mattered is because it protects you against making the same mistakes you've made in the past. You have a way that an organization operates, and it doesn't matter who the entities are. If the organization continues to operate that way, you guard yourself against falling in love with one human being or being held because of a contract or because of a promise or situations like that.
So I'm going to butt in. You know why I'm sick of the process conversation? Because nobody just asked the damn questions. Like, did anybody try and figure out why the process took so long? Like, if we were to get an answer right now, what is the percentage chance that we'd all be like, oh, that makes sense? But we don't know. This is why I'm over the process conversation. Because we just didn't, and I personally sent texts and get answers. And that's what I would say. If somebody asked me, hey, Bob, what happened to the process? I'd be like, I don't know. I tried. But did we try all around? Like, why didn't we have...
Why don't we have more details is what you're saying. To me, it just felt like this is bureaucracy. Bureaucracy takes time. U.S. soccer has a decent amount of bureaucracy. The number of heads in that room seemed to be significant. When you talk about Jurgen Klinsmann, it felt like it was more of a Sunil Gulati move. He wanted him. He went and got him. He had the buy-in within the organization. He was pretty powerful. He got
but
it
you
done.
Don't, no. So I just talked to him about this, and that's also wrong.
Tell me why it's wrong.
That Sunil didn't – I mean, Sunil wanted Klinsmann, but Sunil asked around.
Well, I'm
right?
not saying
Sunil,
he didn't. I'm Sunil, saying he had time to build consensus because he was behind the scenes wanting Jurgen Klinsmann for a long time. But still, that comes down to one man's decision and one man's decision to get other people on board with his decision, which I think is important to consider here because Carlos Cordero had just entered office. And so to expect him to be able to walk around and be like, guys, we're on the same page, I think was maybe a mistake. And that's why some of this made sense. And then you have extenuating circumstance that you talk about, but it goes back to the guys who are making the decision that are part of the process. Ernie Stewart gets hired, but then he doesn't actually take the job for a month and a half afterwards. Greg Berhalter's in the middle of a season. Like, who were they going to get? You want Greg Berhalter to leave? Well, he's probably not going to do that. So if Greg Berhalter's your guy, then you have to wait. The problem then comes back to communication, Bobby. And I agree that it is a responsibility of ours, of media, of the people that cover this game, to dig hard and get those answers. But I also think it's the responsibility of the entity making the decisions to be more clear in their process.
I'm so US soccer. Bored by this conversation.
Okay, fine. What do you want to talk about with Greg Berhalter?
It's not the process. I'm so over the process.
So I will say this.
Everyone has screamed about it, and right or wrong, they're right or wrong, you're right on everything you said, Andrew. I'm just so bored by
so
it.
So my thing is, in 12 months, but probably more 16 months, if the team is good and they're where they have to be and there are young players who are playing better and Greg Berhalter has a competent program moving forward, no one will care at that point.
Agreed.
That's why I didn't want to talk about it, because there's nothing we can solve about it now.
What's important on the field then? You wrote a column that you were very proud of, Doyle.
Yeah. It was a decent column.
Wasn't a list, wasn't an 11.
Right. There were bullet points, though. I think the most important thing on the field is finding out as quickly as possible whether the U.S. is going to be a team that unbalances the opposition with the ball or without the ball. And generally speaking, Berhalter's teams have been teams that unbalance the opposition with the ball. We might not have the player pool for that. We certainly don't have a Federico Higuain-style number 10, but of course you don't need a true number 10, or at least that type of number 10, to unbalance opposition with the ball. And be aware, I mean, Christian Pulisic primarily plays on the wing for Borussia Dortmund, but he wants to be a 10. He wants to play that central midfield role and be the guy who, you know, plays underneath a forward in a 4-2-3-1, or maybe plays in the hole beneath two forwards if we go for a 3-5-2. So there, you know, there is that, and let's face it, figuring out how to best line up the U.S. national team sort of corresponds pretty strongly with figuring out how to get the best out of Christian Pulisic. All that said, if you look at the international game, it's leaning pretty strongly towards either high-pressing frenetic teams like Chile in the last couple of Copa Americas, or low-block counterattacking teams like France, like Portugal, who won, you know, the 2018 World Cup and the 2016 Euros, respectively. And if you look at the player pool coming up, we probably look more like a counterattacking team than anything else. So he's got to figure this out all pretty quickly. And to get back to Bobby's thing, like, it would have been nice to figure that out over the last two or three international dates, at least partially.
You're not going back into the process conversation.
All right. I won't go back into the process conversation. But I think that's the most important thing. And we'll get a hint of that in January camp, because there's still going to be Camp Cupcake, and we're going to see some fringe guys who might end up playing a role, and some guys who we might never see again. But for real, we'll see it in March or in February and March during those full international dates. We'll get an idea of the type of team we're going to see in next summer's Gold Cup. I would be, for the record, I would be fine with any of the above. I would be fine if we're a frenetic, all-out, Red Bull-style pressing team. I would be fine if we are a low block, eight guys behind the ball at all times, Timbers-style counterattacking team. I would be fine if we looked like the Columbus Crew of the last 5 years. Pick one. Get good at it. We're not going to win the World Cup in 2022 no matter what we play, but we can play good soccer, and we can create an identity that actually means something and gives us a chance to put 11 players on the field who know what the frick they're doing playing together, which we haven't seen a lot of over the last 8 years, I guess. We will look like a team that has a system. We will look like a team that actually plays with purpose. If it doesn't get us by France and Brazil and Germany on the big stage, I can live with that. I just want us to play like a soccer team again. And I think Berhalter will give us that.
We've seen that since 2014 with Columbus Crew SC. One guy who benefited greatly from Greg Berhalter, the head coach, was Justin Meerum. He joins us now. Justin, what's up, man?
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing good. Let's just jump right in here on 3G. How'd you find out that he was going to take the U.S. job? It was a badly kept secret, but when did it become official for you?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you heard the rumbling for a while, but you know, we never really brought it up during the season or the playoff run, and you know, we all kind of found out the same time everybody else did. So, not entirely shocked, as you said, it's one of the rumors that everyone was talking about for many months. So,
when you first heard the rumor, though, what was your reaction? The idea that, you know, Greg Berhalter as the USMNT coach.
That the U.S. is lucky that they're going to get someone that has an idea that is going to work tirelessly to bring back the national team to the level it should be. And, you know, I feel since he's been my coach for 4.5 years, you know, he's going to turn some heads in the near future.
So he took over in November of 2013, and then 2014 is his full season. Take us back to those days. Your introduction to Greg Berhalter, where you were, the message he sent to you, because the best years of your career have come under this guy.
Right. It's actually funny. I had ankle scope surgery 4 years ago on my right ankle, and I was doing rehab when he got hired and came into the facility, and just that was the first time I ever met him. It was a good conversation, and then we had one right before the season, and it was more or less, you know, I was playing 3 years before he arrived, so not really established in the league or having good years under myself, and you know, he kind of gave me you know, confidence that he's going to give me you know, some playing time and a full year to impress him, and you know, I never looked back. So definitely a blessing for myself, and I'm sure many others in Columbus, that Greg Berhalter was our coach for many years.
We want to talk about the tactical side with Greg, but first the emotional side. What's it like interacting with him? Because we've seen players like yourself perform so well under him. What is it that he gives to players to give you confidence?
I think he gives a little bit of love, but fear, and a little bit of confidence. I mean, he kind of brings it all to the players and makes sure that, you know, you're ready. But, you know, athletes are difficult. Sometimes you have ones that need to be pushed regularly. Some need to be, you know, cared for. Some need a little bit of both. I probably need a little bit of both. And he's a guy that understands, you know, every player is different and handles it very effectively. And when it comes to game time, he knows how to push the right buttons and really get the fire lit and rolling.
We have covered this league for a while, but Greg's not a guy who loves talking to the media extensively. Is he a talkative guy? Is he the guy controlling, you know, the conversation all the time around the locker room, or does he sit back more?
Nah, he's always talking. There's a moment, you know, I always bring it up. Where I think it was last year, and I walk into the training facility, and you know, before I even go to eat breakfast, he grabs me and he's like, "What? I need to show you one clip." I'm like, "All right, maybe it's from last week's game." It was from a game from 2014. It was a turn I made against DC United, and he wanted me to work on it today, and that training session, and I left his office thinking, "How the hell did that guy remember that play?" But that's Greg in a nutshell. He's always thinking. He's always trying to improve. You know, the details are so fine with him. And I think that's what you see with our team and the culture that he built. And that's just a prime example of who he is.
How did he build the culture in Columbus? How did he get those details ingrained? Because when I think about Greg and I think about the job that he has for the U.S. and what so many of the players have been saying about a plan, somebody to deliver a plan, I have no doubt that Greg Berhalter is going to walk in there with a plan and he's going to be able to communicate that. How did he do that with you guys, and what was the plan? Talk me through kind of the philosophy as you see it.
I mean, do I have to give all his secrets away?
Hey, he's not your coach anymore.
It doesn't have to be secrets.
Nah. I think when not only Greg, but he had his staff, you know, on the same plan, and that plan was delivered daily, weekly, off season. We had amazing plans of how to be ready going into the season. Our diet, everything is. There's nothing up in the air with Greg and that coaching staff. And when you know the task at hand, the schedule for the month, the schedule for the week, getting together as a group, watching Champions League games, it's everything from off the field together, you know, activities to, you know, just getting away for 2 days. We took a trip to the Greenbrier just to get away from the game during a tough stretch. To, you know, hammering the details in training at OBETS a number of times till we get it right. And when you do that day after day for 5 years, you know, it becomes the culture.
When we talk about his soccer philosophy, we always talk possession and pretty soccer. Is that how he describes it? What is it that he told you or would tell the team about who your identity is?
Yeah, we're a team that likes the ball, and don't be afraid to play under pressure, and always move for your teammates, and overload sides to keep the possession. And you know, I mean, there's so many things that Greg is wanting us to do on the field, but ultimately, yeah, we're a possessional style orientated team that looks to break you down with our movements and, you know, keeping the ball. You know, you're not going to score unless you have the ball, and that's how we look at it.
You're a guy who's played international soccer in some of the most extreme conditions, traveling halfway around the world, dropping in the day before a game with players you don't play with all the time. That's the situation a lot for the U.S. as well. How do you see that affecting the way he has to, you know, retell his message or prepare for games or interact with these players?
Right. I think that might be, as I see, could be a bigger challenge for Greg, but because you don't have that time to every day install the tactics or how you want to play. Everyone's playing in different leagues around the world with their own style and their own lifestyle. So I see that being a challenge, but I have a feeling he'll get it right and keeping everyone involved and in the loop and making sure guys are ready before they come into camp, not when they get there. What's the plan? I think he'll have everybody on board, you know, before they show for day one.
You're a guy who straddles a couple different worlds, of course, in Iraq International, but you were eligible for the U.S. What do you think when you look at Greg Berhalter and the U.S. and the players and his style of play and what's to come? You said, hey, they're getting a great coach. How do you think he'll approach that? What do you think his success will look like?
I think there's a lot of really good players in the U.S. When you watch them play, it's a lot of good players with not many ideas collectively. And I think he's going to take that talent, push it to another level, and integrate it as a team and their movements. And I think he's going to bring out the best for many players that you know that just broke into the scene with the national team. And that's going to be exciting for U.S. soccer, and the fans should be really excited about that.
We often call him the forward whisperer. You think about Ola, you think about Giassi and Kai before him. What is it about center forwards and Greg Berhalter's system?
The wingers, baby.
Good answer.
What do you think?
Good answer.
The wingers are key. I think the way we play is built for the center forward. Well, we get our wing backs forward, you know, crosses in the box, running in the box, and I think it's going to be no different with the U.S. Obviously, at the international level, it's a little more compact in the final third, and that's going to be tough. But if there's one guy that I believe in or knows how to break a team down and is going to be up for hours trying to figure it out, it's Greg Berhalter.
That's what's to come for the U.S. Of course, Columbus Crest C has a season upcoming. Your season ended here in the playoffs, and you just went under the knife to get that ankle cleaned out again, Justin. Tell us a little bit about 2018, where your mind's at right now, how this season went, what you're looking forward to.
Yeah, tough season for myself. Obviously, as an athlete, you built many great years, and you want to continue that path. And, you know, when you kind of slip off the radar, no one remembers the years before. They remember the present time. And, you know, I've learned a lot this year and looking forward to getting back to playing at a high level like I have been the past couple of years. And, very tough year for myself. I'm not going to lie. Ups and downs, but, the move was necessary. I always said it. I'm grateful for my time in Orlando, even though it didn't pan out the way I wanted, the club wanted, the fans wanted. But, you know, that's professional sports. And 2019 with Columbus, solely focused on that, not having to worry about, trades or health reasons. And so fully focused for the year. And, that's what I'm excited about for sure.
A Michigan man belongs in Columbus. That's what you're saying, huh?
Well, what can I do when my boys let me down 7 years in a row? My God.
Tough place for Justin Mirren to be right now on the college football front, but a pretty good place on the soccer front. Thank you so much, man, for joining us. Good luck. Recover quickly, okay?
I appreciate it. Thanks, guys, for having me. And Weeby, congrats, my buddy.
I appreciate that, Justin. All right, that's the U.S., but what about the crew? News out there right now, guys, that Caleb Porter and Josh Wolf have already interviewed for the head coaching job. Also, some details there coming from the Columbus Dispatch. The new owners are involved. The Haslam family, the Edwards family, they are part of this search. Pat Onstad, the goalkeeper coach, is now interim GM. What happens next in Columbus is anybody's guess at this point. But Porter and Wolf, any initial thoughts right now with those two guys involved? Porter, of course, so successful at Akron. Wolf has been there under Berhalter in the assistant role.
Yeah. If they want to keep continuity, it would make Wolf the obvious choice. And there's a reason to keep continuity. They've been a really good team for 5 years now. And Wolf is, he's been there for all of that. And he's a really well-regarded guy in MLS circles. He played overseas, played actually with Greg Berhalter at 1860 Munich, I believe it was. The question with any assistant is, can they make the jump to being the full head coach? You don't know until you see it. With Caleb Porter, there isn't that question. You know he can be a pretty good head coach in MLS. He had some low points. He misses the playoffs twice in 5 years, but he also won MLS Cup during that time as well. So you lose the continuity, but you get a guy with a proven track record and probably a higher floor in terms of what he's capable of. So it makes a lot of sense. I'm sure that I would be surprised if it wasn't one of these two guys, but I have no idea where to put my money right now.
All right, we'll see what happens with that. Crusty fans, let us know what you think. There are some other news in Columbus. It's not news. Everything's a little bit hazy right now. Just got to put that out there. But it sounds like January, perhaps a time when those plans for a downtown stadium will come more into focus. The arena district is where they're focusing right now, as well as the ownership side, which remains in flux. So stay tuned for that stuff. No point in guessing. Tyler Adams, no more guessing with that one. He's headed to RB Leipzig. 19 years old, came up through the system, Red Bulls through and through, Academy, USL, Red Bulls 2, team in New York City, Bobby. Now on to the sister club in Leipzig. We knew this was coming, So this is not news. There's no process to talk about. Mm-hmm. Is this a good move for Adams? Is this a good move for the Red Bulls? What happens next?
Feels like a good move for both. I mean, Red Bulls have proven that they can develop a player and send him off to one of the best clubs in Europe. For Tyler Adams, he gets to move to one of the best clubs in Europe. The interesting point on this for me, guys, is the transfer fee. And they did not disclose the transfer fee. We don't know what it was, and there's questions on why that was. And Red Bull's statement is that they never disclosed transfer fee. And there's a question of whether it was really small, if it was something like $750,000, because it's basically the same owner. So the money isn't going to a new person. So New York Red Bulls only need $750,000 because that's what goes towards their allocation money. I hope and I suspect that MLS demanded and asked for it to be a fair market value, because it's really important that MLS continues to drive up the transfer fees, because we talk about needing to get into the world market and have our players move in and out better. Well, that can only happen if it's worth it for MLS teams to sell players. And right now, MLS players are undervalued, and teams aren't willing to sell for that lower than market price.
For what it's worth, I think Manchester City paid fair market value or maybe even a little above for Jack Harrison.
Yep.
So I would expect...
The numbers out there for Zach Steffen seemed in that same zone as well.
I mean, the numbers for Zach Steffen were more than I would have expected.
Yeah, agreed.
So
now, financial fair play is also
not quite
something
the same
to
thing,
think
though.
About.
Because NYCFC to Columbus is not the same as NYCFC.
It's a good point. It's a good point. Within sort of the same organization.
Right.
But you have to think about financial fair play. You have to think about the, let's say, the tax laws in both countries here. The books are important. So we'll see what happens there. What would you think is a, knowing the number for Steffen, knowing the number for Harrison, what would you just speculate might be a fair value? And this is speculation.
Somewhere between 7.5 and 10.
Yeah.
Right? Does that seem right?
I would have said 7.5.
Okay.
10 yeah. feels high.
But he's younger than Harrison.
Yeah.
So you get that.
He has international experience at Harrison.
And Steffen's a goalkeeper, which just changes things. I mean, that's its own category. But, yeah, I would agree with what Doyle said. I would say on the high end of that, like around 9 or 10.
This
is what you'd expect based on Miazga and Josie and all of them as well.
They have shown, the Red Bulls, that A, they're willing to sell, and B, they'll get a return.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily have another Tyler Adams in the pipeline from the academy.
Oh, man. Peter Stroud. Oh, that one's a killer.
Peter Stroud is a Red Bull Academy player who's in West Ham's academy now and is playing for the USU 17s and the Nike Friendlies currently, playing as a number six. His brother is on Red Bulls, too.
His brother's fine.
And Doyle's dying.
His brother's like a squad player at MLS level. Peter Stroud is Peter Stroud's a special talent at defensive midfield. That one hurts.
How much does it hurt the Rebels to lose Adams?
It doesn't. No, it doesn't hurt.
Doesn't hurt him at all?
No, I mean, like, on the field, they're going to have to adjust, but they lost Dax McCarty and they adjusted. They lost Felipe and they adjusted. Like, they know how to do this. Tyler Adams was awesome this year. I have him in my best 11, and that will be missed, but they have Caceres for a reason. You know, he's a really high-rated Venezuelan youth international. He looked good for RBNY2 and in the few cameos he had with the Red Bulls this year. It would hurt Red Bulls more as a club to hold on to Adams a year too long than it'll hurt them to lose him this offseason.
Also, not to change the conversation too much, I think it'll hurt them to lose Parker this offseason more than it will to lose Adams, because Caceres is going to look different than Adams did. They're not going to have the ability to cover ground in central midfield like they did with Tyler Adams, to cover gaps but also to press as high. And so I think Parker and Long are going to be key for them still being a great defensive team next year because of the loss of Tyler Adams.
Still TBD on Tim Parker. Out of contract. We'll see what happens with that one. We know what happened with Tyler Adams. He's off to RB Leipzig. Greg Berhalter is the new head coach of the national team. He will coach Tyler Adams at the international level. 401-206-0MLS. Let us know what you think of that and what Miriam said about the new head coach. Your thoughts go in the mailbag. We're going to break. On the other side, Inter Miami sporting director Paul McDonough.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
I want to raise your spirits. I want to see you smile. Love that means I'll have to.
Back now on extratime radio, driven by Continental MLS Cup going down on Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern. Fox, Unimas, TVA Sports, TSN in Canada. Joining us in just 1 second is Inter Miami sporting director Paul McDonough. He left Atlanta United, where he was a VP on the soccer ops side, to go to Miami and build an expansion squad this summer. Well, he was the man for the job because he had already done it with Orlando and with Atlanta. Of course, had huge success there. Before we talk to him, guys, looking back at how this team was built, at how it was all put together in such a short timeline in 2 years, the success they've had, what sticks out to you? What's special? What have they done? What will other people copy? What's not replicable? Is this just kind of a comet across the sky that you only see once? Or is this the sort of formulaic building process?
I think we're seeing it twice, right? Because LAFC were actually better in their first year than Atlanta was last year. And I think the obvious stuff is they went after a different caliber of South American player than what we've seen in the past. Joseph was a bit of a reclamation project, but obviously a ton of talent there. Almirón was regarded as one of the very best players in Argentina at age 22 or 23. This is a type of player who never made a stop in MLS before. So creating that niche in the world market, and you could, I mean, Villalba wasn't that level, but he's obviously a super talented player. That's one. But two is they did this, they swung for the fences, but were still super pragmatic about getting guys like Parkhurst and Laurentiewicz, guys who know how to win in the league and had something left in the tank, and both of them are out there showing it every single week. I don't know whether that was Paul McDonough or Carlos Bocanegra or Darren Eales or Tata Martino.
Or all four jamming their heads together, who
made those calls, but they did a really nice job of balancing that. My only complaint over 2 years with Atlanta United was they didn't get enough MLS minutes for their young domestic guys. But even that, we saw Miles Robinson give him 90 quality minutes in the playoffs. They've checked a lot of boxes, man.
What I'm interested to see is if there's a you can't talk about Atlanta United without the money they spent. You know, we could be like, oh, it's cool that they brought Parkhurst and Laurentiewicz back to all-star levels. It's cool that they've gotten the most out of Julian Gressel and Escobar and these guys who might not otherwise have been stars. But you can't talk about the team without spending the money. And I'm most interested in the fact that where there's now a threshold on spending that money. Where if you spend 3 to 5 or 6 million in Major League Soccer, you might miss. You know, you might get Josue Coleman or Lucas Molano or something like that. And I'm curious now if there's a number that you just can't miss at. If you spend over $7 million, which they did 4 times on this roster.
Are we maybe already in the middle of that experiment with Barquito? Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
But he's 15.
He's a different example because he was a development project. The other three were players who had proven it and were kind of just getting to their primes. And Barco was clearly the development project, which is a little bit of a different situation, but maybe. So that's what I'm interested in, is as we look at teams spend more money, if you tell yourself as an organization, oh, if we actually just put in the extra couple million, that guarantees us.
Giovanni Dos Santos. Oh.
That's fair, but they didn't buy him, right?
They didn't. I thought there was a transfer fee.
But not, I'm thinking for like six. I mean, they have 4 guys on their roster they paid big transfer fees for. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my thought experiment on Atlanta, whether this is an idea where in Major League Soccer, if you do spend the extra few million, if it is some increased probability of success.
I will just throw this out there. I think we're at the point with MLS Academies, every MLS Academy is creating guys, every good MLS Academy is creating guys who, if they were South American, MLS teams would be tripping over themselves to pay $3 million for. Every single MLS Academy is doing that.
All right, let's talk to Paul McDonough. He is currently the sporting director at Inter Miami. They're building a squad right now. But he was before that the VP of soccer ops at Atlanta United. He was hired in 2015, left this summer. He's on the line now. Paul, how's it going?
Good. How you doing?
We are doing good, and we just got done taking a look at the building of this Atlanta team. And you go back through it, and you were such a big part of it, you and Darren Eales and Carlos Bocanegra and Tata Martino, once he came on board. And we're struggling to find misses. Is that how you felt as you were building it? Just like, oh, man, these pieces are just locking into place.
I mean, you hope it all works out. I think, you know, there were a lot of conversations. There was a lot of ideas, a lot of planning. And, look, I mean, I think it starts with Arthur. I think the advantage for us was that Arthur had been through build with Home Depot and a startup, and he had the experience of being a Falcons owner. So, you know, he just set a real culture for us. And then when we started planning, you know, as pieces started to fall together, it started to come together really nicely. Look, free agency helped us. You know, the influx of TAM money helped us. Certainly hiring Tata, then all of a sudden, you know, you're getting a player like Emil Assad, who he knew, and we got him on a great number, and his production for the number was great. You know, and Emil ended up moving on, but we were able to trade and get some really good assets and reinvest that into the team. So, yeah, I if you ask any of us, we would love to tell you that we planned it that way, but we were very fortunate with a startup that so many things hit well.
The first few weeks, the first few months, is there like 18 big boards of like 500 want DPs, 500 TAM level players, 200 expansion draft potentials. Like, what does all of that look like? How do you start?
Yeah. You start with a board. You start with a board, and you know, if you talk to the guys, they would tell you the board changes all the time, right? Because you have so many pieces to get, and when you start adding pieces, it gives you flexibility to go get somebody else. You know, once you start adding in guys, everything starts to take shape around it. But our board probably changed weekly. You know, and as you get closer, you don't have as much flexibility, so it doesn't change as much.
What did you learn from Orlando City? You walked in and kind of take me through the way you guys worked, the roles, the responsibilities. I mean, you had a team. I look around other clubs in MLS, and it's often – it's just not as big. It's not as experienced. It doesn't have the varied experience that you guys had.
Yeah, I think the larger technical staffs started to really come in. I think probably Seattle was the first one to go with a larger technical staff, as far as outside of the coaching staff with multiple people. You know, they always had Garth, Chris Henderson, or Adrian and Chris Henderson, and Kurt Schmidt. You know, they had different guys. And I think, you know, in Orlando, you know, Orlando was a different concept when we started, right? We started with a three-year build. It was the philosophy was going to be long-term. And the team did pretty well, and then all of a sudden it changes, right? You want to all of a sudden compete right away, and you kind of go away from that plan. I think going to Atlanta, Arthur was really, really good about establishing that culture, and you make a plan and you go for it. Now, in Atlanta, we were fortunate, you know, that the time between expansion from Orlando to Atlanta, the influx of PAM, free agency, discretionary spending came in, so that allowed you to build better teams. Now look, Atlanta was resourced much better on a DP front than other teams, so we were able to build a better team. But also, Darren really drove this mission of winning right out of the gate. Right. So we used to laugh all the time, and Carlos used to go crazy because Darren and I would always be sitting there and we were signing a player. We were almost like we're moving all of our chips in. And the same around our place was we're going all in, you know, but we knew that it wasn't going to be a 1 year thing. We wanted to keep the team together for a couple of years.
Miguel Miron, you talk about going all in. That's one of those bets that paid out, we assume, very soon, extremely well. But take us back to the process of identification, of pursuing. Why was he the right player for you guys at that time?
Yeah, we had seen Miguel early. And then, you know, the price tag was something that was really scary. It had never been done in the league before. And as we kept, you know, we came home and we had everybody watching video on him, and we kept going back and seeing him. And we sat in a room one day and we were talking, and kind of this idea about, you know, look, you can go get an older player and you can spend $5 million a year and you get no return on investment. You know, all we're asking for is a, you know, we're just looking for $8 to $10 million up front and, you know, over 5 years it amortizes out at the same rate. You know, you're $25 million in over five, but you can still turn and sell him. And look, it's worked out perfectly. The kid's been a home run, and you know he's going to go on and play in a big league, and his impressions that he leaves on Atlanta and the league are enormous.
Where did Tata then step in? How did that change the build? How did that affect, you know, who you're looking at and how you're closing the deals?
You know, Tata came down when we were interviewing him and we were talking about players, and he certainly had a real idea of players he liked. Miguel was a guy he really, really wanted. You know, we were in conversations with Miguel, but Miguel was being chased by suitors. You know, one stage, Darren, Carlos, and myself were down there. We were meeting with Miguel. Miguel, you know, asked the question. He says, look, there's rumors. And we said, look, hang tight. You know, the coach will call you. And when Tata called Miggy, it changed everything for us, because Miggy all of a sudden said, forget about Europe. I want to go to Atlanta and I want to play for this guy. And it helped push Lanús into a deal. So Tata's arrival certainly helped us bring in credibility to getting a guy like Carlos Carmona, you know, getting Yamil, you know, Joseph Martinez. You know, when he made a call to people, it meant something to them. for us to get them.
Joseph Martinez has hit in droves. I mean, 30-plus goals this year. When you signed him, though, and we were talking about this, he was a little bit of a reclamation project. He's at Torino. He's playing a little bit on the wing. As a group, what'd you see in him? What was the pitch to a guy like Joseph? And when you see the number of goals he's scored this year, despite the fact that you were part of that process to sign him, are you still a little bit surprised? Is it still a bit shocking?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, to find a striker that scores a goal a game and do it the way he does it, he scores all types of goals. Yeah, I think anyone would be surprised that he has been the scorer and scoring at the rate he has. But it's just something that clicks, right? He's in a city that loves him. The fans are crazy about him. He loves them. He's comfortable. And usually when players get into that real comfort zone, they're successful. And I think that Miggy was a big part of Joseph being settled. But, yeah, I don't think anyone could ever say that we thought Joseph was going to score at the rate he scored.
See, good. Did you know he was going to be a striker? I mean, what did you see at Torino that you said, okay, wing is not for this guy. We need to get him up top.
Well, we need a striker, but we also knew we had Tito, right? So Tito could give us flexibility to play as a nine. We were just looking for another player, and we just liked Joseph, right? We liked his abilities. We liked that he could play as a nine. He could play out on the wing a little bit. He could play underneath. So we were looking for a little bit more flexibility within the group. At the time, we had Kenwin Jones. You know, we thought Kenwin would come in and score some goals coming from the league he was in. That didn't work out that way, but Joseph came in and picked up the slack, and his mobility and his aerial game and just the way he clicked, you know, the three amigos clicked up front. It was really, really good.
You talked about the large technical staff for this club. There's the star players, and everyone's looking at that. But what's been so amazing about Atlanta United was getting Gressel in the draft, hitting and moving pieces around in the expansion draft, Michael Parkhurst, Jeff Larenowitz in free agency. How do you divide up the responsibilities of trying to find all those pieces for a roster, and how do you start to fill in that back end?
Yeah, look, it's funny, right? The way it worked out, you know, we were working. I mean, it came down to relationships. A lot of it was relationships. You know, Carlos had known Parkey, you know, same agent, represented both. There was a conversation there. You know, Darren and I were so drunk on getting attacking players, Carlos was desperate to get in some defenders. So, you know, he really pushed hard for that one. You know, but I think it comes down to relationships and timing, right? Timing. You know, Brad Gazan wanted to come back. Carlos had known him. We were in the process of trying to get Sean Johnson. The deal with Chicago for Brad wasn't going well. You know, we really thought, you know, we liked Sean, and you know, but we thought that, hey, we can move Sean, we can get Brad, and you know, everybody can win. So timing was a really, really big thing for us. Free agency, I think, when you show players, this is the stadium, this is the training ground we're building, it really resonated with guys, and they saw that it was a professionally run club. So I think that helped us a lot.
There's the obvious stuff here, Paul, but there's a lot of things I have to imagine that you feel pride in on a little bit different level. What's something that you're really proud of that the group accomplished while you were there that you were a part of that maybe doesn't get the headlines the way a Miggy or a Joseph or even a Tito Villalba does?
I think you're just really proud of the whole thing. It was received so well in the community. You know, I think the people there don't get enough credit behind the scenes. I think, you know, the staff that was put together at that club, from the support staff is top notch, and the culture and the environment in and around that club is fantastic. From, you know, you got a guy like Matt Moore in digital media and Chris Winkler in Atlanta in communications, Skate in marketing, you know, Paul Dillon, the equipment guy. I mean, he makes the place run. And I think when you get people like that, it's just a good place to work. And I think, you know, for me now where I am, you know, trying to replicate that culture piece for me is huge. And that's hard to do.
So tell us about Inter Miami. You get the job. you're being asked to do something very similar to what Atlanta did, I assume, which is jump in and compete. What's the job? How are you approaching it right now? And what can you tell all of us about the progress you've made?
Yeah, every build, you know, this is my third now, right? Every build is completely different. I believe in the ownership group here, very much like in Atlanta. And I think that's important, right? I mean, ownership is super, super important. And, you know, David and the Moss brothers and Marcelo, you know, they're just good guys, and they're really going to support what we want to do. So really for me now, you know, I started in August and only employee. We've got two more now. We've hired a chief business officer from CONCACAF, Jürgen Mika. We brought Dennis Sprinkle in to be head of human resources from Orlando. And really for us, we're trying to get all the infrastructure done. Spent a lot of time going out in the community, meeting all the local soccer people, kind of giving them our vision. For us, we're going to start the academy this summer. Really want to focus, you know, 12s through 19s, all on South Florida. I don't think we'll go outside the market and bring kids in. You know, it's really got to be about South Florida's team. We're picking a training ground site right now. So training ground, you know, needs to come and happen for us. We've been interviewing architects for the last couple of weeks, and we're down to our last few architects for that. And then really just got to start staffing up, got to get some academy coaches in. I'm going to add to my technical staff here soon. And then we're going to start the scouting process for the first team and you know, hopefully a USL team.
For fans out there, give them some dates of stuff that could happen, when to start getting excited, when to start checking things out.
Yeah, look, I think the academy will be the first thing for us, right, in the summer. You know, we'll do a lot of signing of players probably come the summer. I think January is probably a little too soon for us just because it's a year away. But the player signings for the first team will probably start up late spring, summer. You know, we'll add a coach by then. And then, yeah, I mean, that's going to be the time frame for us.
You've been a part, you mentioned, of two builds already. For Orlando, a signing like Kaká was, at the time, a game changer in this league. Then Atlanta, a few years later, they sign a player like Almirón. The league's changing consistently. For a guy like you who's been through this and made some of those changes, those predictions, what do you see as a next step in this league?
I think the interesting thing is a lot of the technical staffs around the league are getting really, really good. I think the most important thing is you have to find out who you are and what you want to be, and how you can build your team. There's so many different ways. You see how people build teams. You know, you've got an FC Dallas that has, you know, some international players and a lot of young players, and, you know, what Peter Vermes is doing in Sporting Kansas City, you know, what Red Bull have done with the homegrown players and some international players. You know, for us, I think, you know, we're still talking about it. You know, do we go with, you know, a couple older DPs, or do we go the young DP route? You know, I think the hard part is when you go the young DP route, Miguel Almirón doesn't grow on trees. So that's going to be really hard to duplicate.
And in terms of coach, what's the idea of what type of profile you're looking for, what the process is going to be like?
No, it's an open process. You know, we're still having discussions on it. David, you know, we're going to see David on Friday, and we're going to talk more about it. And, you know, do we want to go with a European coach, a South American coach, a domestic coach? I think, you know, for a global ownership group, one of the things they really focused on in the technical director search was that they wanted someone that understood the league. So I think that there's a lot of validity to look that way for a coach also. You know, again, you know, like in Atlanta, Tata Martino, you know, they just don't grow on trees. You know, he was a big name coach, but he also understood the league and he wanted to be in this league. This league is not easy for just any foreign coach to come in and take over.
I have to imagine you have a rooting interest this weekend, Paul. I mean, you're an Inter Miami guy now, so there might be a rivalry coming. But somewhere in your heart, there's five stripes.
Yeah.
Now, how are you going to deal with this game?
Listen, I think what Gavin and Merritt have done in Portland is great, and I think the job Gio's done is fantastic. But when I was leaving, I said Atlanta is my team until January 1st, 2019. So I am rooting only one way this weekend.
He helped build it. He's now at Inter Miami doing the same thing. His third build in, I don't know, 5-6 years at this point. Paul McDonough, the soccer can I call you soccer czar at this point? I mean, I don't know if there's anybody else, Paul. So you're the top of the pyramid.
No,
that's about it.
Garth Lagerwey. Garth Lagerwey has that.
Gotcha. That belongs to Garth. We'll figure out Paul's nickname later. Thanks so much for joining us, man. Good luck. We'll follow with interest.
Thanks, guys.
Man, always good to talk to Paul. Big things happening in Miami. But some of those nuggets on Atlanta, I mean, it's sometimes easy to forget that it's not this easy. That it's a lot of work and a lot of luck and a lot of investment went into it for Atlanta United to get to this point, to be on the brink of an MLS Cup triumph. Maybe. Yeah. We'll see.
What amazes me, it's a blank sheet of paper. I mean, you look how hard it is to bring players in to fit in with a team that already exists. But just to start from complete scratch and build a cohesive unit. And I think one of the things that I heard from Paul, but you know, about the future of this league is knowing your identity more. I think it used to just be, let's bring in talent. Let's bring in the most talent. Let's have as much talent as we possibly can under our salary cap and make it work. And I think now you're in a place where you need to bring in talent that fits a certain
gotta
philosophy.
Be the right talent.
Yeah.
Got to be the right talent. Can't just be a random collection of guys. They really did an amazing job in Atlanta over the last couple of years. It's a tapestry, man. And it all fits together, and it all fits together under the salary cap. 8 p.m. Eastern, Fox, Unimas, TVA Sports, TSN, MLS Cup. The Portland Timbers against Atlanta United. By the way, Timbers fans, don't feel left out. We got Gavin Wilkinson coming on Thursday. Tune in for that. In the meantime, we're going to the break. Mailbag on the other side.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at Extratime Radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
I just want to believe in something. I don't care if right or wrong. I just want to believe in something. How can I make
back now on Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental into the mailbag. And we have a fifth member of our crew. The mouse that lives in the studio just ran across my feet. So it's not like the radiator
or anything.
Been
sitting very still.
I was. Very quiet. Peaceful.
Dad skills.
All, you know, everything is just happening around me. It's a blur, and I am but the consistent presence. I don't know where I was going with that. MLS Newswire for you. We didn't have time to talk about these. But David Villa signed with Vissel Kobe. He's joining Andres Iniesta and Lucas Podolski in the J League. Forrest Lasso, the USL Defender of the League year, signed with FC Cincinnati. Mark Anthony Kay got a 3-year deal in LA, and the CCL draw happens tonight. So we will plot out our heartbreak months in advance. Let's get right to the mailbag. 401-206-0MLS.
Martin from Sweden. First off, congrats to Wiebe, but as with any deal, there's a few questions we need to ask. Sure, Wiebe's been God the last few years, but how long will he be able to keep that up? Is he on decline? Is now really the time to strike a deal with him? Does this run a risk of labeling her as a retirement league? Shouldn't she go for young South American with potential rather than Wiebe? Or maybe even gamble on a Scandinavian? Yes, Andrew Wiebe got engaged this weekend.
By the way, I'm a huge fan of Martin from Sweden. Sure, Wiebe has been, I'm reading this verbatim, has been a god. Has been, no, just God, just singular God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I'm engaged now. Yeah. So it's another thing for me to beat to death on
which,
this podcast.
I think if you listen to this show, you know has been coming, and Ben in Beaverton says, are you kidding me with this announcement? This process has taken how long? And we are still supposed to get excited for this move. They even use new youth players as an exploitation for more clicks. All I can say is that I hope it lasts at least one cycle, that we see some decent possession, and that people are patient and understanding throughout the ups and downs. Congrats to Andrew
this
on his
is
engagement.
A, this is a multi-cycle.
This has been Berhalter-esque.
Yeah, this is a multi-cycle signing. I hope, you know, we'll probably be playing World Cups on the moon, and I hope I'm still rolling along strong. Shout out to Mindy.
So did you drop the ring in a grate?
I am not an idiot.
Did you
I would
see
never
this
do
story?
This in Times Square. That person is an
well, he's,
idiot.
He's from England.
Idiot.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I would never do it over a grate.
Yeah.
Idiot.
So I don't think he did it over a grate. I think he did it, and then when they were walking away, they were passing the ring back and forth.
Idiot.
To look at
getting
it or
engaged
something.
In Times Square, though.
Oh, you're
like,
passing
like,
the ring.
Let's get engaged in the worst place on earth.
Mindy, well, magical. Bobby lives on the border of the worst place on earth, so he's getting a little awkward face here. Mindy just like refuses to take the ring off. That's how scared she is of losing it.
Mm-hmm.
This couple they have a lot of questions to be answered. That press conference is going to be tough for them. Mine is a breeze. It's a cakewalk. It's a big win
so
for the Weeby brand.
So Weeby, I mean, press conference. So like, so what's next? What should we expect?
January camp is coming. I don't think we have any new call-ups, but we're going to run Cam through his paces.
Uh-oh.
No new call-ups. Probably going to go the opposite direction from Dave Sarakin, who was all about new faces. We're going to keep the same group together for a long period of time.
I was just talking to Simon, who, of course, really is kind of our boss when it comes to content. He was asking for a column from you on MLS cities ranked by tier in terms of bachelor party destinations.
Ooh.
He should also ask for one about...
Can we count Nashville? Can we count Miami? Even though they're not
I think we can.
League?
I think
because
we
that
can.
Would change.
I think, because like Miami, Nashville, and Montreal... Probably tier one.
Oh wow, that is tier one.
Montreal might be in a tier.
I would throw Colorado. I'm going to throw Colorado in that same tier because I want to go skiing. And now, as a person who has a kid, in case you forgot that, I don't have as much. Free
Any other
time.
Things you like to do available in Colorado, Andrew? Or
ski, mostly ski. Okay. Enjoy the outdoors. Hike, depending on the time of year.
I think that we should have this article also for real estate and what's most affordable for a family and good schools, because that's the article Weeby really wants
exactly.
to tier MLS.
So exactly. trying to get you to move to Westchester already.
Uh-huh. Lander's saying that I'll be in Beacon in just a couple years. Months. Ooh.
We're not allowed
Weeks.
To say Red Bulls for that answer?
Explain.
To go to Jersey?
What's happening? Bobby, you've said two words this whole segment, and they've made zero sense.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And moving on from that, and Andrew, let's get into the mailbag. Anonymous, just listen to your review of Thursday night's game. Maybe hold off on the brown liquor special and wait till Friday. I enjoy listening to the pod, but the conversation got heated and sloppy.
Yes, that's what we're going for.
Hey, man, if you want us to
that's
come in
actually,
on Friday.
That's what we're aiming for in 2019. Extra Time Radio, heated and sloppy.
By the way, you just gave Dave.
Yeah, the new intro.
The new, well, that and also a crock pot. And so Dave's dinners
are
from here on
sloppy.
Out is heated and sloppy as well.
I don't
that's
think, like, honestly, crock pot cooking isn't that sloppy.
I'm going to be stew city. I'm going to be eating every stew you've ever heard of.
Nice.
And then ones that don't even make sense. Yeah, I'm going to have cheese doodles in there.
401-206-0MLS. Any slow cooker recipes are welcome.
Do you ever make hushway?
No.
I got to cut you off there. Get back to the mail.
Ron, Timbers fan, long time, first time. What should we learn from the two coaches' prior experience in championship matches leading into MLS Cup?
So one of those coaches wins a good number of those. That's Giovanni Savarese. Yeah, come on, 3 out of 4 in the last 5 years? That's pretty good. Pretty good, Bobby.
We can't put on charts on a podcast, but if we could put on the chart of the amount of money they spent compared to the competitors.
True. I mean, but look, Martino was at Barca and he didn't win one.
Small club Barcelona.
1 year, guys. And he made 3-5. Like,
sure. I mean, but he didn't win them.
So there you go.
I mean, that's
what
whole
you
point
can
here.
Take.
I mean, I guess that's what we take.
1 year.
Fine.
Okay. Martin from Sweden, when he's not talking about Andrew Weeby's engagement, says, at what point do we consider Valeri the best player in MLS history? If he wins MLS Cup for Portland again,
God, stop.
This time against the second best ever regular season team at their place, can we at least stop referring to any other player as a maestro and let it clearly be him? I also thought about how you said about only a select few players being able to perform regardless of team. Surely he is one of those players.
I feel bad not... Going back to the original question, not actually answering that, because I think it's a worthwhile thing to answer.
Also, Martin prefaced this by saying he's the biggest Valeri fanboy in Northern Europe. So that's where this comes
you
from.
You don't actually want to talk about the coaches and finals thing?
You can. You were the one who was flipping.
I just scoffed at Andrew's point real quick.
Drink. Everyone drink.
Point.
Now that we've moved on to a new question, Bobby brings
no, you have to tell him. We're going to cover
slamming
that.
Slamming it into reverse.
We just had a meeting. We're definitely going to cover that on the Matchday Central shows at 7 p.m. the rest of the week.
He's learning. Plug the other cassette.
Well done, Bobby.
We're all formulating our thoughts to have a more thought-out answer.
This email comes from Andrew in Colorado.
We're not going to address the Valeri thing then?
I don't know where you guys are at anymore.
Mm-hmm. Valeri,
he's not the best player in MLS history. He won't be. He is an iconic individual. He was an iconic signing for the Portland Timbers. He is by far the best player in their history and will always be someone who their fans
identify
with.
Him and Chara are 1 and 1A.
No, Valeri's definitely
Valeri's one.
We love Chara, but yeah, he is not
Valeri's
in the Valeri
one. Valeri's the type of guy that you go to Providence Park in 5 years, there's a statue of Diego Valeri.
Oh, if, this is good.
His connection if they to win, the Thorns.
There should be a statue of Chara slight tackling the opponent 5 yards behind
it. I actually love that
and
idea.
And avoiding
That's
a yellow card.
That's an incredible idea, to have dueling statues of the Diego.
They should put it right under a street light that never turns red or yellow and just stays green.
There are two players in Major League Soccer who full-on legitimately deserve a statue for what they've contributed to their team and to their city, Kyle Beckerman and Diego Valeri.
I don't think I would argue against that. Valeri's great.
How far behind Robbie Keane is Diego Valeri if they win this MLS Cup? Because they both – Keane had three?
Keane had three in his first 4 years.
Yeah.
The eye test matters too, though. Valeri's amazing and very, very good, but he is not in that Jovinko, Robbie Keane, David Villa at his peak. There's still another echelon that he's not in. That doesn't take anything away from him. It's just the eye test says he's not in that top
I actually
echelon.
Think he's much closer to David Villa, and to me, past David Villa. He has the championship. He has the MVP.
Well,
they both
test.
Had injury issues.
Give me the eye test.
True.
Who's a better
player when
you
watch? Last year he was completely dominant. Every single moment they needed something, he gave it to
them. He scored more goals last year.
But that to me, goes to Diego Valeri.
Dominant's a different word.
He has multiple facets that he's shown throughout his time. I mean,
say
he's
this.
A great player.
He is one of the two most consistent, high-level, pure number 10s in league history. The other being Echeverry, who did it for like 5 or 6 years right at the start, right out the gate, and was unquestionably the central player on the first ever true MLS dynasty in what is still arguably the best team ever. Valeri's not there yet. He's not Diablo level, but like every other number 10 is a level below that, and Valeri might end up being the best of them.
We decided earlier when we were just walking and chatting that he is the best one of this decade. He beats out Higuain. He beats out probably number two is Morales from RSL.
Yeah, I think so.
But Valeri over the last 7 or 8 years.
Lee Wynn, Benny Failhaber. Mm-hmm. Guys who've won a lot, have been in MVP races.
Matt worked really
Higuain
hard.
Higuain as well.
Matt worked really hard to get Mauro Diaz at number one, but we compromised.
Yeah, didn't happen. That happened.
Taylor from Switzerland, I appreciate your conversation about Kansas City and their inability to get over that semifinal hump. Time and again, every year it seems like a narrative always comes back to KC needing a focal point player or consistent productive number 9. My question is, when does Peter Vermees get the blame for this? It's been a position of need to get them over that line for years now, and yet every year they come up short offensively in the playoffs. Vermees needs to demand they sign a game-changing offensive-minded player or they'll stay the fourth or fifth best team in the league.
You know what, though? They're not gonna, because if you look at their roster, they have Nemeth under contract for next year. They have Rubio under contract for next year. They're bringing back Kyrie Shelton as well. Those are their forwards. All their wingers are under contract. Felipe Gutierrez, who had those chances, who had two of those chances, is coming back as well. He's under contract through, I think, 2021. And by the way, congratulations and well done to the Sporting Kansas City front office for an amazing season and Peter Vermees for an amazing season and to that communications department for being willing to put out their end of season press release about their roster and have all this information in there, because it makes it better to cover the league. It allows us and allows fans to talk about teams more intelligently. They need – look, if you don't have a center forward who can score you 15, 18 goals, then you need a Diego Valeri-type midfielder who will score you 15, 18 goals. And they don't – I don't think they have either of them. They probably thought Felipe Gutierrez was going to be that guy. He was in position to be that guy. He did not get the job done.
I'll echo what Matt said about their PR department, but also they signed Johan Quaze. Quaze was their big attacking signing. So
one
we
of
give
them.
Vermees.
One of them. I mean, Gutierrez makes three times as much as Quaze does.
But different roles. I think Gutierrez was meant to be this all-around midfielder, and Quaze was supposed to be that literally the exact guy that they needed at moments this year and just wasn't. So we give Vermees a ton of credit, but he also has whiffed a couple times on this.
So Leanne has a question. She said, I was sad to see SKC's season end last night. They gave us a really fun year. I've been having some questions and thoughts about their formation for a couple weeks. She said she's not a soccer expert, but the crux of what she's asking, and she sent us her DM, so I'm going to boil this down for you, is Graham Zusi's attack from right back was some of the best moments and the best attack that they had. Fontes looked good when he stepped on the field. Why not play some form of 5-3-2, 5-4-1 with Madranda and Zusi as wingbacks? And her then question at the end of that was, is it because it doesn't fit Russell and Shallowy?
I think so. Those are the two best finishers on the team, right? Are Russell and Shallowy. And if I guess Rubio as well, and there's no room for either of them, really, if you're going to play a 3-5-2. Plus, it's Vermes. Like, I think Vermes is a really, really good coach in a lot of ways, but he's not flexible when it comes to his formation. He's flexible when it comes to tactics, and we've seen an evolution over the last 8 years in terms of how they play the 4-3-3, but it's always a 4-3-3. So, like, don't even...
Which is interesting, because he made his bones at one point in the three-center-back system. Right,
he was a sweeper.
You know, he's done it. He has the knowledge. It is,
but he's from the Dutch school. That's, you know, that's where he, you know, played a lot in Europe, and it's what he prefers, and he's had a lot of success with it. Mm-hmm. So you can't knock it too much. By the way, let me throw this one out there. This is my mailbag question. If Josh Sargent, instead of signing with Werder Bremen, signs with Sporting Kansas City a year ago, Sporting Kansas City beat Portland.
No.
Ay.
No. I'm big on Sargent. I mean, Diego Rubio had just played for Chile 3 weeks ago. Diego Rubio has a ton of talent in there.
You think he's as good as Josh Sargent?
Yeah. If you had asked me to pick a player this season, I love Sargent, right? I think he's going to be better than Josie and all that. But yeah, this season I would have picked Rubio.
I actually think, going back to the number 9 conversation, the real issue here is Christian Namath.
Yeah.
That's the inflexibility. It's not Quaze. Quaze is not a great signing. You're not starting him. He was useful at times, but rarely special. It's Christian Namath, who they traded for, and then didn't play, basically. What's his role?
Yeah. He didn't look like he was worth it, to be honest with you. And I assume that they only traded him for him because there was the opportunity to get him at cheap, because they gave up nothing for him.
Right.
And I think the Revs ate a big chunk of his contract.
I know this might have been a ridiculous question and comment, but I do understand what you're saying, not because Josh Sargent's a better player than Rubio, because he's a different player. Rubio doesn't interact with the players around him very well. He doesn't set anyone else up. Josh Sargent does that pretty well. I know Josh Sargent's 19. Right. So to say the whole thing would have changed because of him is tough.
Would Josh Sargent be better off if he had gotten 2,500 minutes with Sporting Kansas City this year?
I don't think we can say that yet. Because we don't know where his career is going to be.
Look, I think Sporting Kansas City,
that's a good January camp.
Sporting Kansas City would be their fans, I think, would be more at peace with that loss if Josh Sargent is the forward than otherwise, because you would feel like you are building something and you have a tighter U.S. national team player.
Christian from London, England. I could go into detail about this, but the deal is perfect, so I don't think I need to. Aaron Robin to FC Cincinnati. I mean, that's the dream. McLaughlin and Aaron Robin tearing down the wings.
Aaron Robin on turf? No thanks, man.
Aaron Robin to the Union to pair with Mario Balotelli. As the transfer rumor mill is telling us right now. Yes, please. I will take that.
Am I the only one who's just like a hard pass on Arjen Robin?
Yeah, you are the only one.
No, I love Arjen Robin.
Yeah.
There's these guys. One thing you and I fundamentally disagree on.
He's 35.
I don't know where you guys stand on this.
As a reasonable signing, whatever. But like, guys, I would
this isn't
to
a logical
play.
Thing. This isn't just like, this please is like a let me watch
in
this.
In sports, you just need that. Like Schweinsteiger, Rooney, Zlatan, and Robin. Like they're this tier that it's just...
Robin is not in that tier.
Other he's than more he's, fun than any than, of the other guys.
Other than
named.
When he's playing Mexico in the World Cup.
What say you?
I like that.
Studio Mouse, what say you about this take?
Last one here, Johnny from the Six. I was wondering what you thought of the first signings of the Canadian Premier League. Haven't really heard you guys talk about the Canada PL.
We didn't.
And I'd be interested to hear what someone kind of outside of the Canadian soccer sphere would think about it. So Kyle Becker signed with a team. I don't know. They signed Canadian players across the
MLS
board.
MLS combine hero, Kyle Becker.
Yeah. Yes. Indeed. Did Toussaint
Or
Ricketts?
As I call him, the Canadian
No,
Luke
he didn't.
No, maybe not. Maybe at some point. I don't have a ton to
Kyle
say
Porter
yet.
Kyle Porter signed.
Oh, right.
Nick Ledgerwood's
Skylar Thomas.
Yeah. Of all Canadian players so far and then one Swedish player.
I think it's a great idea. It's super cool. I don't know what to make of it yet.
I hope it works to a... Like, I hope it's a smashing success. I hope they get a lot of these guys who have been maybe marginal pros in MLS and not quite good enough to build a team around in USL, but I hope they all find a home in Canada. I hope the paychecks never bounce. I hope that they play good soccer, and I hope that it does a lot for Canadian youth players who are, you know, good at 15, 16, 17 years old and maybe not good enough to break into MLS or USL teams, but find a place where they can play against professionals who are playing for their livelihood, because that matters.
Matt hopes all that, but mostly that one of them gives minutes to Andrew Carlton.
Andrew Carlton's not Canadian.
All right, and
if
on
they
that
could
note,
give up,
what
they
a great show!
Oh man,
has Bobby just like
I think the
a
issue
lot
is,
of red herrings in this mailbag, or is it
normally we have Ben in here? I don't think Bobby's 90 minutes.
He's not mailbag fit.
Yeah, so he's like the guy. He's our Kyrie Shelton. Normally, Ben's our Diego Rubio, who comes in, scores in the last 10 minutes,
but gives you very little else.
Yeah.
Right.
So if we had Josh Sargent in here, I think this mailbag would have been better.
401-206-0MLS. We're out of here. Thursday's the big preview. Gavin Wilkinson is going to join us. We'll see you then. Have a great week, everybody.
I've done everything.